Since 1775, generations of Americans have fought for our ideals and our principles. American warriors secured the freedoms to create the United States of America. They fought to end slavery. They joined with allies to win two world wars. They have responded with valor and honor whenever called. And they have liberated more people around the globe than any military in the history of the world. Our all-volunteer forces of guardsmen, soldiers, sailors, marines, airmen, and reservists continue the mission begun at Lexington and Concord. Less than 1% of Americans serve in our armed forces. The least the rest of us can do is to pay attention and get engaged. The American Warrior is on the air.
And good afternoon, folks. Welcome to another great segment of American Warrior Radio. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. Great show coming up. Please stay tuned. We know you're going to enjoy it. But let's start like we usually do with This Week in Military History. At 4:30 a.m. on this date in 1861, Confederate guns opened fire on Fort Sumter, the first shots of the United States Civil War. Over the course of 33 hours, Confederate shore batteries lobbed 4,000 shells at Fort Sumter before the garrison finally raised the white flag. Now, despite that huge number of shells fired, no one on either side of the conflict was killed during the battle itself. However, as they were departing their position, the Union soldiers decided to fire a gun salute. Some cartridges exploded prematurely, killing two Union soldiers. Today also marks the 70th anniversary of the death of President Franklin Delano Roosevelt. Less than 30 days before the Allies' victory in Europe, his death shocked the nation and marked a critical turning point in the war when his successor, Harry S. Truman, decided to take a tougher stand with the Russians. Roosevelt was the only president to serve four terms. On March 21, 1947, the 22nd Amendment to our Constitution set a term limit for the office of president. Let me tell you about Staff Sergeant Henry E. Irwin of the United States Army Air Corps 52nd Bomber Squadron. Irwin was the radio operator of a B-29 leading an attack over Koryama, Japan on April 12th. In addition to operating the radio, he was assigned the additional duty of dropping phosphorescent smoke bombs to aid in the assembly of the bomber formation when the launching point was reached. One of the phosphorescent bombs proved faulty and exploded in the launching tube and shot back into the interior of the aircraft. The ordnance struck Sergeant Irwin in the face, completely obliterating his nose and blinding him. Smoke filled the aircraft, and Irwin recognized that the crew would be lost if the burning bomb remained in the aircraft. Without regard for his own safety, Irwin picked up the bomb and began feeling his way blindly towards the co-pilot's window. When he was blocked by the navigator's table, he grasped the still-burning bomb in one arm while releasing the spring lock and raised the table, struggling on into the pilot's compartment. Groping with his burned hands, he finally located the window and threw the bomb overboard. Completely aflame by this time, he fell back upon the floor. The pilot was able to recover the aircraft and flew on to Iwo Jima. Once they arrived, medical personnel doubted Irwin would survive, and Army Air Force officials approved a Medal of Honor award in a matter of hours so that Irwin could be presented with the citation while he still lived. But Staff Sergeant Irwin was an American warrior, and he did survive. After 30 months and 41 surgeries, his eyesight was restored and he regained use of one arm. He was discharged from the Army in 1947 and died peacefully at his home on January 16, 2002. Folks, they don't carry weapons, but from the very beginning of our nation and our nation's military, chaplains have played a key role in the spiritual and earthly substance of our soldiers, airmen, marines, and sailors, and their families. On the phone today, we're very pleased to be joined by Jeff Strucker. You're going to get to know Jeff here a little bit. He's the lead pastor at Calvary Baptist Church in Columbus, Georgia. He served 13 years enlisted with the 75th Ranger Regiment and was the winner of the Best Ranger Competition in 1996, along with his partner, Isaac. Help me with this one, Jeff. Gamazel, okay. Jeff, you served in the invasion of Panama and in Kuwait during Operation Desert Storm, among other things. But most folks will probably recognize you. In 1993, you were the squad leader assigned to Task Force Ranger in Mogadishu, Somalia. And during the Battle of Mogadishu, you led rescue convoys in and out of the fire zone, the battle that was memorialized in the movie Black Hawk Down. After your enlistment ended, you went on to seminary and were commissioned a chaplain, returning to serve our nation with airborne and ranger forces during Operation Enduring Freedom in Afghanistan and Operation Iraqi Freedom. You retired as a major in January 2011. Did I get that all right?
You got it.
Okay. Folks, I want to encourage you to visit jeffstrucker.com. It's spelled S-T-R-U-E-C-K-E-R.com to learn more about Jeff. And Jeff, let's start off with, you've got an amazing story to tell, but you're also quite a prolific author. You've published 6 books. The Road to Unafraid was your first book. And tell us a little bit about the motivation behind you penning that very first book.
Yeah, I got a lot of requests after the book and the movie Black Hawk Down came out to speak to audiences because there's a character who plays me in the movie. And by the way, Brian Van Holt is this actor who is much better looking than I, so I think a lot of people thought, well, get that.
I don't know, Jeff. I've seen your picture. You're a poster boy.
So anyway, you know, when the movie and the book Black Hawk Down came out, because Brian Van Holt was using my actual name in the movie, lots of people started asking me, Jeff, will you come speak all over the country, schools, corporate events, lots and lots of churches, and I'm talking thousands of invitations. I was still on active duty, and there's no way I couldn't take 10% of them because I was so busy. A couple of publishing companies approached me about writing a book, and frankly, I wasn't interested. I mean, I was never even interested in my name actually making it into the book Black Hawk Down or onto the screen in the movie. So I wasn't at all interested in writing a book, you know, just to get my name out there. And one publishing company, especially Thomas Nelson, said, Jeff, here's the truth. This book will go places you will literally never be able to go, and it will be read in audiences that in your lifetime you will never be able to go to. And they were right. So they kind of convinced me to go ahead and start writing the book. But I'm still on active duty, and I got a really busy schedule because I'm going back and forth repeatedly to Iraq and Afghanistan. And so they helped me by giving me what I consider to be one of the best co-authors in the business, Dean Merrill, who he really deserves the credit for The Road to Unafraid. I don't. It's just my story, but he made it awesome.
Now, of the six books you published, it's interesting in that you made a transition to writing fiction. And I found that really interesting. What motivated you to do that? Tell our listeners a little bit about that transition.
It's very practical. I was going back and forth to Afghanistan and Iraq. My wife, Dawn, and I were buying copies of my book, The Road to Unafraid, and just giving it away free. I didn't write books to make money. In fact, I have made almost no profit off of all six of these books, which is totally fine with me. So we're buying copies of books, and I'm giving them away while I'm overseas in Iraq and Afghanistan. And guys are really excited to get the book. They all ask me, hey, will you sign it? And then they don't ever read it. Literally, they just put the book on a shelf and never, ever open it up and never read it. And I was getting really frustrated. So I started watching, what are these guys reading? They're not reading my book. I'm giving away a lot of other Christian books. They're not reading those. So what are these guys reading? And I would notice they were reading books by Tom Clancy and by John Gresham and thrillers like that. And so I came back to the States after one long deployment to Iraq and said to a friend of mine who was my literary agent and who knows the publishing industry very well, I asked him, what is a book that's written specifically for men? It's got a good moral Christian message in it, and it's action-packed. And my friend said, Jeff, that stuff doesn't exist. It's you can't find it because it's never been written. And then he said, you need to start writing them. And so I started this fiction series to do just that, and I started giving those books away. And at least people are opening the covers of those books.
Well, and the message is getting out there. And I think that's the key of kind of what I want to talk to you about today, your progression from being an elite soldier to a chaplain. Was interesting, but when people hear more about it, I don't think they'll be very surprised. We've got a couple of minutes before the first break, Jeff, but if you would, just some logistics here. Describe for our listeners the role of a chaplain in our modern military today.
Sure, yeah. A lot of people will call the chaplain, in military terms, a force multiplier, which means when that person is on the battlefield, the unit is more effective, better able to do what the country's asking them to do. And I think there's a lot of truth in that. In my opinion, this is just Jeff Strucker's opinion, but in my opinion, the chaplain does several essential things in a unit. First, the chaplain provides a moral framework, a moral compass for the unit. And I don't mean just the commander. That's how it works in the Army, Navy, Air Force, and Marines. The commander is the person, man or woman, who's calling the shots. But for everybody in overseas in combat, that chaplain, when the chaplain is in the room, that chaplain is a moral, just reminding everybody, of what what our country's asking them to do. And I think in a couple of cases where the chaplain, where there were some moral failures in combat, and I don't mean just Iraq and Afghanistan, but in the last 50 years or 70 years, chaplains weren't there. So I think the chaplain is a moral presence on the battlefield. I also think the chaplain has the ability to say to the commander what nobody else will say. And I mean this in total honesty. A chaplain that does their job really well should understand the unit, understand the people in the unit, and should understand the climate of the unit. And on many occasions in combat, as a chaplain, I've gone into my commander's office and said, boss, you have a problem. And no one else in this unit will tell you, but I'll tell you to your face, here's what the people think. And he said, chaplain, that can't possibly be true. And I said, it's the truth. Go ask him for yourself. And in every case, my commanders have taken that advice and, you know, used it to turn the conditions around.
Now, Joe, is that my brother served in the military in a position where none of them, they all had rank, but none of them wore their rank, if I can put it that way.
Yeah.
And it's similar. Chaplains are addressed by chaplain, not by the rank. Is that so
exactly
they can
right.
maintain?
That's correct. In the military or in the Army, now the Navy and the Air Force also has chaplains, and the Navy has chaplains that they supply to the Coast Guard and to the Marines as well. So in all cases, the chaplain is referred to by their title, chaplain, and not by their rank first. But I wish the day would come that chaplains never wore rank at all, and people only recognize them as a chaplain.
Wonderful. Folks, this is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We'll be right back after this break. We're joined by Jeff Strucker. Jeff is a veteran of the Battle of Mogadishu, more commonly known as the Black Hawk Down. Interesting transition from an elite warrior to, I'll say, an elite chaplain. Stick around, folks. We'll be right back after this break.
The United States of America, joined since 4 July 1776, are known as exceptional. There are many reasons for the compliment, not least of which are the people who pledged their lives for all of us.
And we're back, folks. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia, here in American Warrior. We're talking about chaplains in our military. We're very, very proud to be joined by Jeff Strucker, who is a veteran of many conflicts. Now, that's not even a serious term, but he evolved, progressed, transitioned from being one of the elite warriors, an Army Ranger, to a chaplain. And Jeff, you were a Ranger who chose to then be a chaplain. What influenced your decision? I found it interesting that it wasn't necessarily, if I may borrow the phrase, that, you know, a come to Jesus moment, because you had a strong faith prior to that. But walk our listeners through that point in your life where it dawned on you that you had perhaps a larger calling.
Yeah, Ben, you're exactly right. I had a very strong faith in Jesus before I joined the Army, so long before I ever went to war. The one word answer for what caused me to become an Army chaplain, because I loved being a Ranger. It was something that I planned to do as a Christian. I loved it, and I plan to do it for the rest of my life. The one word answer to your question is Somalia, but I'll explain that a little bit. When I was in Somalia, as you already told your listeners, I had previous combat experience in the invasion of Panama, in Kuwait, in Desert Storm. So I've been around combat before, and I've been around death and bullets and bombs and blood. That stuff, I'd been exposed to it before. So Somalia really didn't scare me, per se. It was, for me, it was an event that caused me to reexamine what's really important in life, and especially in light of eternity. So here's basically how this went. I'll be very brief. I'm leading this column of Humvees through the city streets early in the mission on Black Hawk Down. One of my men is killed. He's the first guy, Dominic Pillow, the first guy to get killed in our task force in Somalia. And the whole rest of the night, I'm in the city streets, and we're getting shot to pieces all night long. And most of that night, I was totally convinced that I was going to die. And some of your listeners may not even understand this, but all night long, I had total peace about my future because I believed in Jesus. I believe in heaven. I know exactly where I'm going to go. So I just did my job and really felt no fear when everyone else in the task force was freaking out around me. So for me, the most pivotal event in Somalia was the day after this big firefight. Because the day after this big firefight's over with, all of my friends who I've been working with, living and eating and training and sleeping with for years are coming up to me the next day saying, Jeff, there was something very different about you, and I want to know what it was. And I had this sense, I didn't hear an audible voice, but I had this sense from God that he wanted me to do something different than just be a ranger and fight our nation's war. He wanted me to make it a difference in the souls of men. And ever since then, I've had this burning passion to be able to talk to men, especially really tough men, and tell them there is no kidding a hell, there is really a heaven, and everybody is going to one of those two places one day. And I think it's more important to settle eternity than what happens even here on earth. So That's the events that led me to become an Army chaplain.
Now, Jeff, you chaplains go everywhere. They follow their flock, if you will. You had the advantage, though, of having served in combat, as you said, you know, facing bullets and bombs and death. So after you transitioned and became a chaplain and you're talking to your soldiers out there, you had the, or would you say it was an advantage to not just have a theoretical answer to their questions, their concerns, but you're coming from a standpoint of been there, done that, I know what you're facing.
Yeah, it wasn't just a theoretical advantage. It was a huge opportunity. And I would also tell your listeners, it was a great responsibility. I didn't take this lightly. When I walked in the room, people recognized my name from Black Hawk Down, and they immediately gave me credibility that a lot of other chaplains had to work really hard to earn. I told your listeners in the last segment, chaplains were this moral presence on the battlefield. They're a voice of truth to the commander. But the truth is, the chaplain's most important role, and this is really why the military has chaplains today, is they either provide or perform religious services for soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines. And when I did that, I could look guys and gals in the eyes and say, I know exactly what you're going through. I remember it very well because I was in your shoes one day. And I tried to be the kind of chaplain that I would have wanted when I was an enlisted soldier. So when I did religious services, when I counseled them, I could say, hey, I've been there, got the ticket or the T-shirt. Let me show you how much of a difference faith made for me.
Now, Jeff, I consider myself blessed. I have never struggled with my faith. I guess it's kind of in my DNA. I've never had, you know, I may have some disputes with God on the way he does things, but I've never been concerned about the reality of it. As civilians, most of us think of death as somewhere down the line. It doesn't cross our minds on a regular basis. But in the military, I would guess, particularly in the combat zone, this is something that they have to, you know, there's nothing like looking death in the eye to start a theological discussion. What are some of the advice you would give to those soldiers, in your case, that were having those kinds of struggles?
You're absolutely right. I try to use this phrase very, I wasn't ugly with it, but I would remind them, hey, you guys are in the business of killing and being killed. So you have to settle this. Don't put this off. And I would tell your listeners who've never been in the military, never gone to war, though it was a terrible privilege, it was still a privilege to be put in a position where we had to think about death often. Because when you put death in the equation, everything else starts to become really clear. I mean, your priorities start to become really clear really fast when you realize, I may not be around tomorrow. And this is the way many American warriors live and are still living because of the war in Afghanistan for 15 years now.
Wow. Well, so a lot, just to, I guess, kind of maybe the direct question I wanted to ask you and maybe our listeners need to hear is, how do you, as both a warrior and a man of faith, as a pastor, how do you reconcile the issue to your soldiers of being a Christian and going to war and being called to others? And potentially being called to kill others?
Okay, great question. And this is probably the most often asked question I've got in my life as a military chaplain. And I have no issue whatsoever. In fact, I think I can make very strong arguments from the Bible that there is no contradiction in a person, man or woman, being a very strongly committed Christian, a passionate follower of Jesus Christ, and also a soldier or a sailor or an airman or a Marine. And I don't mean just those people that are working in the hospitals or in logistics, but a combat soldier who's on the front line and who has the mission to kill the enemies of our country. In fact, I think this is depicted not just in the Old Testament, but it's also depicted in the New Testament. And I would say, I would take it even a step further. I would say one of the most loving things people can do for our country is to say, I care enough about it that I'm willing to fight to protect what we hold true and hold dear to us, or I'm willing to die trying. And a Christian should be more willing to make that statement than anybody else out there, because you have the promise of eternal life in Jesus.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so you, I guess from what you're saying, you would not, General George Washington actually in 1775 petitioned Congress to establish the Chaplain Corps because he felt it was necessary for the military to be provided with spiritual substance. So I'm guessing you agree with that concept, that it applies on up through today.
I agree completely. When I was an enlisted soldier and going to combat as an Army Ranger, I felt no contradiction in being a believer in Jesus and a combat soldier in war.
Now, Jeff, this might be typical of a Ranger, but I'm still not clear on your position. You feel strongly about that?
I think I settled this one a long time ago.
Hey, folks, this is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. Great interview here on American Warrior. We're talking to a warrior chaplain, Jeff Strucker. I encourage you to visit his website, jeffstrucker.com. That's Strucker spelled S-T-R-U-E-C-K-E-R. Jeff, we're going to talk more about the role of the chaplain and some of your advice, but want to delve into in the next segment about the, you know, talk more about the Battle of Mogadishu, if you'd be willing to chat with our listeners about that and share some of the, you know, so different talking to someone who was actually there.
I'd be happy to.
Wonderful. Folks, again, your host, Ben Bueller Garcia, joined by Jeff Strucker here on American Warrior. We'll be right back after this commercial break.
Who expect to reap the blessings of freedom must, like men, undergo the fatigue of supporting it. Now, back to the American Warrior.
We're back, folks, here in American Warrior. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're joined on the phone by Jeff Strucker. Jeff is was a chaplain. He's currently a pastor, a Baptist church in Georgia. But Jeff also served in the 75th Ranger Regiment, saw a lot of combat. In particular, Jeff was intimately involved in the Battle of Mogadishu, made famous through the book and the movie Black Hawk Down. Jeff, we had Colonel Larry Casper on American Warrior before. He was there as well, but his perspective was, I'd say, a little bit more detached than yours. You were in the heart of the action. If you don't mind sharing with our listeners a little bit about that, let's start off with the fact that you, as a Ranger, you guys were sent in a little bit earlier. You'd seen a couple of other missions before the mission that resulted in the Black Hawk Down incident, is that correct?
Yes. When you use the term Task Force Ranger, we're not just talking about Rangers, but mm-hmm. basically three units always go into the city doing combat operations together. Helicopter units, some other special operators and Rangers all going in together, all coming out together. And by the time we did this big battle on Black Hawk Down, we had already done six previous missions, and they were pretty successful. But none of them could hold a candle to what happened to us on this final mission, October 3rd and 4th, 1993.
Was there a sort of a building sense of tension there on the base prior to that Black Hawk Down action?
Well, our missions were building in intensity. So, yeah, I think most of us realized this. I'll say this. All of us realized this was going to be bad, but none of us anticipated it was going to go this bad. So two things were happening kind of simultaneously. We were doing missions that were becoming a little bit more daring and a little bit more dangerous. I mean, this is what the U.S. government sent us over there to do. We weren't there to hand out food with the United Nations. We were there to kill or to capture some high-ranking people and to try to give the people of Somalia a chance at peace. And each of those missions are becoming a little bit more dangerous. And at the same time, we originally went over with what we thought was going to be about a six-week operation. We're 3 months into it, and Washington, D.C. is breathing down our neck to wrap this thing up and to get out of there. So when we get this tip that two of these really high-ranking people are in the same building at the same time, it's a golden opportunity. But it's the conditions are, it's in broad daylight. Rangers and special operators, they do their stuff at night with night vision goggles because we're a lot more effective at night. And this is in the heart of the deed-controlled part of the city. I mean, this is bad guy. This is wild, wild west that mm-hmm. we're going into. And all of us knew that. But it was too important to let it pass by. So by the time we launched this mission, every one of us know this could go bad. But none of us anticipated it could go this bad.
Now, there's a scene in the movie where I think the general comes up as the group is just departing for the mission and says good luck or something to that extent. And one of the pilot turns to the other and says he's never said that before. And they have kind of that look in their eye.
Yeah.
You know, baseball players and military.
Yeah.
No one could have had a sense, but did you feel a little different vibe going out?
No, actually, yes, we did. And that. Your listeners need to know, the movie Black Hawk Down is exceptionally accurate. So a lot, almost everything you see in the movie happened very much like you see it happening. The real deal was just much more violent than what you see in the movie Black Hawk Down. So Major General William Garrison, to this day, one of the most brilliant military commanders I've ever worked for, Garrison said to us before this mission, the worst thing that would happen in this task force is if helicopters start getting shot down.
Mm.
And then we go to Black Hawk Down, and we're in the middle of this firefight. And your listeners need to know that of the six helicopters that are transporting troops, we have many more than six helicopters in the air, but of the six that are transporting troops, five of the six get shot down. Two of them crash in the city, and the other three crash in places where we can get to them and get everybody out. So it wasn't a disaster, but like I said a couple of times now, nobody anticipated the kind of enemy that we experienced.
Now, you were in the convoy. This whole thing started with Private Todd Blackburn when he failed to make his faster open and was injured. You were part of the convoy that was bringing him out. I think it was at three vehicles, or?
That's correct.
And you... your Humvee experienced the first death in the battle, Dominic Pillow. I mean, obviously you're going through some pretty intense fire, but was that this is going to be a bad day?
Yeah, that's the moment where I started to think, I'm not going to survive the next 10 seconds, let alone the rest of this night. And that was pretty much what was going through my mind all the rest of for the next 18 hours, that I'm not going to survive the next 10 seconds. This intense firefight that we went through was from point-blank range. And it wasn't just one or two guys shooting at us. It's 200 guys shooting at us from point-blank range at one time. So I have often said it is unexplainable that any of us came out of the city streets alive. All of us should be dead right now, and certainly I should be. But, yeah, Dominic Pillow is the first guy killed, and I think when I announced on the radio, just like the movie Black Hawk Down shows, that Dominic Pillow is dead, everyone goes silent because they all realize, it could be me, and it might be in the next few minutes.
Now, when you got back to the base after that, when you returned Private Blackburn, you were commanded to go back out again. And you, from what I've been told, you grappled with not going back out. You just heard your wife was pregnant with your first child. You know, kind of coming back to what led you to become a chaplain. You had some challenging moments that first time out as you're washing blood out of your Humvee.
Yeah, that, as you just described, was hands down the most terrifying moments of my life. Because, as you just said, I'm just bringing Todd Blackburn back. He's all shot to pieces. Dominic Pilla is dead. My vehicles are shot to pieces. And almost immediately after getting back, my platoon leader, Larry Moores, is telling me, Mike Durant's black hot. Just got shot down. We don't have anybody who can go back out there, get on the Humvees, and go see if there's any survivors. And all of my men and I looked at each other like, we're all going to die. If we drive back through that, we're all going to die. And for me, I had to settle. Jeff, do you really believe this, what you said you believe about Jesus, or was it all just words? And at the moment of my greatest fear in my life, God gave me this supernatural sense of peace. Yep, you're going to die in the next few moments, but it's okay. Because I know where I'm going to spend eternity. And for the rest of the night, I didn't worry about dying. I was convinced it was going to happen in the next 10 seconds, but it didn't matter anymore.
Now, Jeff, I saw an interview where you spoke with, to me, speaks to the power and just what a wonderful group of men and women we have in the military. You say that pretty much you and your comrades, okay, we know we're going to die, but you had orders. And so you mounted up again and you went back into the fire.
Right. the American warrior is amazing. That man or woman who's on our battlefield fighting for us right now is an incredible human being. And the guys that I had the privilege of serving with in Somalia, every one of us believed when we drive back to the city streets, we're going to die. But I'm not going to leave the crew of that helicopter to have nobody to try to rescue them. So let's go. And all of these guys jumped on those Humvees with me, and I have never been more proud to serve with men in my life than the guys that I had the privilege of serving with in Somalia.
How many times did you go back in and out then?
Three times that night. Spent all night long out there until 9 o'clock the next morning.
And in the final, I think they call it the Mogadishu Mile, were you involved in that? Were you?
Yes. Well, I was kind of indirectly responsible for the Mogadishu Mile. I'll be really brief.
Is that a good thing or a bad thing?
No, it's both a good and a bad thing. We've loaded up all of the dead. We've put all of our casualties on vehicles. As many vehicles as possible are taking them to get them immediate medical attention. And there's still a bunch of guys that are on foot. And me and my men are on two Humvees. So everybody drives away from the crash site. This is at about 9 o'clock the next morning. And as they're leaving, I'm the last two vehicles to drive out of the crash site that day. We get about a half a mile down the road, and the guy who's operating the 50 cal on top of my Humvee calls down to me and says, "Sergeant, there are men running down the road chasing after us." And I said, "Well, obviously they're bad guys, so just go ahead and kill them." And he said, "No, those are our guys, and they're running out on foot." So me and one other vehicle, we stop what we're doing, back down into the crash site area, and I put as many people as physically can hang on to a Humvee, dragging their feet on the ground, and drag them away to the nearest UN compound. But we can't get everybody on our vehicles. And so the last half of those guys have to run out of the crash site on foot all the way back to our compound. And my vehicle is so weighted down with men hanging off the sides that it's driving at like 5 miles an hour with full power.
Wow, powerful. Now, Jeff, you returned to Mogadishu in 2013. I think you were probably one of the first members of Task Force Ranger to do so. Want to talk a little bit about that when we come back after the break, because I think I would say that that involves some forgiveness and leads us back to the idea of faith in the military. Folks, this is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. Powerful, powerful stuff with Jeff Strucker. We'll be right back.
My daddy served in the Army. We lost his right eye, but he flew a flag out in our yard till the day that he died. He wanted my mother, my brother, my sister, and me to grow up and live happy in the land of the free.
If you want to discuss those who serve the red, white, and blue, dial 520-751-1041. If you want to support them, start with WoundedWarriorProject.org. Now, back to the American Warrior.
And we lit up your world like the 4th of July.
We're back, folks, here on American Warriors. Your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. Wonderful and inspirational interview today with Jeff Strucker. Jeff is a retired member of the United States Army, served in the 75th Ranger Regiment, one of our elite Special Forces warrior. But then at the end of his career, he also served as a chaplain to airborne and ranger units. He's now a pastor in Georgia. Jeff, we spent the last segment you describing just the extreme, extreme violence. I think you've described as the most intense firefight in your life there at the Battle of Mogadishu. And yet you chose to return to Mogadishu in 2013. Was there some sort of a sense of forgiveness or closure involved with that decision?
Yes, absolutely. But I also think I was halfway crazy when I did this. My friend Kenny Thomas, he and I are very close. He was in Somalia with me. And about 2 years ago, he approached me and said, "Jeff, would you ever consider going back to Somalia?" And I said, "Kenny, that's crazy. Mogadishu, Somalia, right now, today, is still the most dangerous place on planet Earth. Why would you go back there?" And he said, "Well, I'm not really saying that I'd go back there, but I'll go if you'll go." And I said, "Well, I guess I'll go if you'll go." And it was almost that quick. And both of us realized there's something still that needs to be, I think the words that he used is some closure.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe this had to do with the way that we left Somalia. It was very abrupt, and in my opinion, it was very insulting to us that fought the battle, for lack of a better word. I could use different words, but I better not on this radio program.
Yeah, please.
So we both decided we would like to go back there and to see the ground that we actually fought on. Now, you know that Mogadishu is a very, very dangerous place because of the terrorism that's going on in there. And Kenny and I went over there kind of as much as possible under the radar. We tried to get to the exact location where this big battle went down. And both of us, when we came back, said, man, I don't hate Somalia. I don't hate the Somali people. I don't even hate the people that were fighting against us. It was a very bloody, very violent war, and I'm a different man having gone through it. And as much as I would never want this on my worst enemy, I am glad that I'm the man that I am today, and Somalia played a big role in that.
Now, there's a scene from that segment that I saw where, as you're driving around, you guys are talking back and forth on radios, and it sounds like your driver says, well, that's my house right there. And you kind of like, whoa, 20 years ago, we did a lot of shooting by your house.
That's exactly right. His house was next to where we did our third mission in Somalia, and we got into a really big firefight right at his house. So he was probably an infant when all of this was going on.
Did he have do you have an opinion on that? Or
we talked about it after it was over with, but as you could probably tell from this video, all of us were highly stressed out driving through the streets. So we didn't have a whole lot to say to each other during that little trip through the city streets.
Sure, sure. Jeff, we talked earlier in the show about the advantage that you had having seen combat in places other than Mogadishu, and or I should say in addition to Mogadishu, and how that adds value to when you're working with your soldiers out there in the role of a chaplain. Apart from on the battlefield, what are some of the other roles that chaplains play with the airmen or soldiers or sailors or Marines and their families? I think that's something that often goes overlooked. We so often think about the chaplain down in the trenches, but there's a lot of work on the home front.
Right. I said in the last segment that the American warrior is an exceptional human being. I will tell you that the chaplain is also an exceptional human being. I mean, the men and women who serve as chaplains in the military, they don't have to do this. You know, nobody's twisting their arm to do this, and they do it for love of country. Most of them do it for love of their faith, but all of them do it for love of the American warrior. And chaplains are counseling right there at the spot of crisis. Chaplains are advising the commander before. I think there are 10,000 cases of where something catastrophic could have happened, and it didn't because the chaplain was there. No one will ever be able to quantify that, but I'm convinced 10,000 times it could have happened, and it didn't. Chaplains are there to take care of the families, and everyone realizes today if the family fails to stick with this fight, then the warrior doesn't stick with the fight. So the chaplain's there in all places and in all through the whole process, and thank God that the men and women that are serving as chaplains in the military right now.
Now, Jeff, the whole mission of this program is to educate and inform the 99% of the population that never served. So I think some of us, as we go through our daily lives out there in our communities, we're not thinking that we still do have men and women deployed in harm's way. What are your thoughts, or what are your suggestions on what civilians can do to support those families of those warriors who are serving our country?
Two things. Don't ever stop praying for them. Not until the final battle is over with, not until we can say it's over, it's complete. And those days are not yet in front of us. You can just tell that from the fight with ISIS right now. That's one thing. But the second thing is the military family really needs to know how important they are. For the most part, the men and women who sign up to serve in the military, they do it not for the paycheck, because let's face it, it's not a great paycheck. They do it because they just want to hear their countrymen say, thank you, and we're proud of you. And many of them will get the chance to hear that from time to time, not often enough. But the military family almost never hears that. And the sacrifice that they go through is unmatched. So I think the spouses and the children need to hear thanks. Thanks for being willing to give up your dad or your mom or your brother or sister to fight this battle for me.
Jeff, I would guess that one of your more challenging roles as a chaplain is to do death notifications.
That is the worst.
What is one of the, some of the more joyous moments that you experienced as a chaplain?
Without question, one of the best points about being a chaplain is when I have a chance to counsel somebody and to see the light come on and to help them, to really, no kidding, help them through a serious struggle. Or for me personally, it's to be able to do religious services for them and to be on a mountainside in Afghanistan or on a dusty alleyway in Baghdad, Iraq, and to say, I'm here for you, man. When the bullets are flying and the bombs are dropping around you, I'm here for you.
Wow. Ranger Creed.
Yeah, that's right.
Now, you still, there as a pastor in Georgia, you're still engaged with the military. Do you have parishioners that are active duty military that attend your church?
A very large population in not just my church, but in many churches, because Columbus, Georgia is right outside of Fort Benning, one of the largest military bases in the world.
Okay, and a random access question, Jeff, because I'm getting kind of old. You are Protestant. How is it determined which theologies are represented in the chaplain corps? Is it based on the faith of people enlisted, or?
Oh, you ask a very good question. I can speak for the Army, but I think this is true of how the Navy and the Air Force does it as well. In the Army, the Army looks at percentage of soldiers by faith, and they say in a perfect world, if 27% of our soldiers are Catholic, 27% of our chaplains will be Catholic. If 12% of our soldiers are Jewish, 12% of our chaplains will be Jewish. The problem is we don't live in a perfect world, and so the military does as much as they can to make those percentages match up, but it doesn't always work out that way.
And I think it's important to mention also that the military does not, I mean, they give you the office of chaplain, but they don't determine who's, I mean, basically you have to be ordained as a pastor before you can be a chaplain. The military doesn't make that decision.
That's correct. The government does not pay for, nor do they provide a means to be a chaplain. They just simply say, okay, you've met our criteria. You've met all of the standards. We are willing to accept you to become a chaplain.
Jeff, any last thoughts you'd like to share with our listeners?
I just want your listeners to know, it really was one of the greatest privileges of my life to be able to serve as a warrior. But the real privilege was to be able to be around my heroes, soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines. They're my heroes. And I love those guys dearly.
Well, I tell you, Jeff, on behalf of the listeners here in Tucson and, gosh, all around the world listening on the Internet, thank you for your service and your continued service as a pastor.
Thanks so much.
And don't forget, folks, visit jeffstreuker.com, STREUCKER. You can learn more about Jeff. He's got a great blog there. You can look at some of his books and some of his experiences. Listen, like us on Facebook, American Warrior Daily Mail. What a powerful interview. It's so important that these messages that we're communicating here on American Warrior go out to you and to those who support those men and women serving in our military. So, hey, check out our podcast. All the shows are archived there. You can download them in your convenience of your own time in your home. Visit 1041kqth.com. Click on the On Demand tab. American Warrior Daily Mail will be right there for you. We'll be back next week with another great guest. Thanks for tuning in, folks. This has been your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. Thanks to Jeff Streuker. Take care, Tucson.